This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Crimea is seemingly now part of Russia, despite international objections. And the large-scale protests against the Ukrainian government that have been going on for months have seemingly resulted in a divided country becoming even more divided. Many Americans are asking what the U.S. and our European allies can really do to hold Vladimir Putin and Russia responsible.
I think we have to be realistic about what sanctions and financial pressure can do, especially in the immediate term. I've said often these are not a silver bullet. They're not going to roll back the troops from Crimea. They're not going to, you know, pull down the Russian flags flying over the cities in Crimea at this point. So you have to see what the effects are. And I think long term what you can do are impose real costs on Russian economic interests and prestige. You want these measures, if you're going to deploy them, to punish and deter. But you obviously don't want to aggravate the situation, and you don't want to incur countermeasures that are going to be detrimental to Western interests. I think that's the reality.
That's Juan Zarate, a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking to NPR's Morning Edition earlier today. Today, Where We Live, Ukraine, Russia, and Crimea in the middle. What can the U.S. and Europe really do, and why should we care? We're going to take your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. Emails where we live at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at Where We Live and check out our show online at WNPR.org and on Facebook. Coming up in a bit, we'll talk with two professors following this crisis, one of whom was in Ukraine during the Orange Revolution. But first, I want to welcome back Senator Chris Murphy, who just returned from another trip to Ukraine with a delegation of U.S. senators. Senator Murphy, welcome back to our show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the Colin McEnroe mug.
Oh, of course. We want to make sure that you're well taken care of.
I appreciate it.
So you just got back from another trip to Kiev. Let's first of all talk about who you were going with and what you were trying to accomplish.
So I was there originally in December with Senator John McCain. We went right after President Yanukovych had first marched his security forces down into the square to try to break up what to that point had been peaceful protests. And we went because we wanted to make sure that people who had the who wanted to grieve their government could do so in peace. We went back now to Kyiv and Ukraine under very different circumstances, now with a new government, Yanukovych having fled, and Russian troops marshaled in Crimea. And we were there to really present a bipartisan message. We had not only Senator McCain and myself, but six other Republican and Democratic senators. And our message was that we are going to be there to support the new government in Ukraine with economic support, that we expect to pass a $1 billion U.S. aid package, and that we aren't going to allow this Russian aggression to go unchecked, that we believe we've got to have a series of sanctions that ratchet up that may have the potential of changing the situation on the ground, but at least send the message to Russia and to other nations that may draw lessons from their invasion in Ukraine, that if you want to reset your borders outside of the norms of international standards, then there are going to be serious consequences for that. It's a very tense place right now, a very confusing place because it's hard to understand what Putin's motives are and what his next move are. But I think they were glad to hear Republicans and Democrats coming together to support them.
Throughout the course of our program, we're going to be talking a lot about what those serious consequences could be, about sanctions against Russia and about that relationship. But I want to get back to your trip to Ukraine and talk about the government there. When we last spoke and you'd been there while the protests were going on, I think we spoke a little bit about what that protest movement would turn into in terms of Ukrainian government. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of an update on where you see the Ukrainian government in this now western part of the country, not Crimea, but the part that that essentially was trying to join the European Union, at least its influence and sphere earlier last year. I'm wondering if you can just give us an update of how that's coalesced and how you think that's come together.
Well, I think first an important frame for our discussion throughout this hour is that while Crimea is incredibly strategically important both to Russia and to Ukraine, it still represents only about 5% of the population. And so it's important to note that while Russia has control of Crimea, no doubt today, still 95% of Ukraine is run by this new government out of Kyiv. Now, the protests may have started because they were upset. People were upset in and around Kyiv that President Yanukovych had decided not to sign an association agreement with Europe. But the protest became something very different than simply a pro-European, anti-Russian protest. The people that were coming down to the square most often talked to us about a desire to restore integrity to their lives. And that meant different things to different people, but it was about getting corruption out of government, getting truly free and fair elections, stopping leaders from using power to enrich themselves. All of it was framed by a desire to be part of Europe. But that's the challenge here, is that this new government, I think, is doing well so far, but hasn't necessarily addressed all of the concerns of the people on the square, because you essentially replaced one set of politicians with another set of politicians. And ultimately, while they want to see the protesters and the million-plus people who are on the Maidan, the square, want to see Ukraine join Europe, they also just want to see a better-run government. And that move to get corruption out of the sort of daily lives of Ukrainians, that is a long process. It is social. It is cultural how badly corruption is built into the daily lives of people who live in that country. And we have yet to determine whether the new government can deliver on that promise.
But that's really important, I think, for us to understand, is that looking from afar, this seems to be a story about Russian influence in an eastern part of the country that maybe speaks Russian and perhaps may be under the influence of Vladimir Putin beyond just Crimea, and a western part of the country that wants to move toward Europe. What you're essentially saying is, on the day-to-day level, the people just want a better government. They didn't have a good government before. They want to end up with a better government tomorrow.
Yeah, but part of that story is the fact that they have had a silent hand of control from Moscow for a very long time that has been trying to influence elections, that has been supporting some of these leaders that have stolen from the people. And so there is a story that connects their worries about corruption and the influence of Moscow. I think there's also some confusion about East and West. I mean, there is not a dividing line between East and West, and all of the West wants to join Europe, and all of the East speaks Russian and wants to become part of Russia. Remember that from the reports I've seen are that over half of the people that were killed on the Maidan had Russian last names. And so it's not accurate to suggest that, well, the people who speak Russian, well, they want to be part of Russia. That's not true. Most of the polls that have been done, even in the eastern provinces, suggest that the vast majority don't want to be part of Russia. And I think that's part of the reluctance right now of Putin to move into that portion of the country, because he doesn't have the support there that he has in Crimea.
We're talking about Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia today on the program with Senator Chris Murphy. We'll be bringing in some professors who've been following this very closely in just a bit. But we want to get your questions as well. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. With the delegation of senators that that you traveled with, I'm wondering if the conversations are about how to move forward now that Crimea has essentially become part of Russia, or if anyone in your delegation feels as though this is somehow not an accomplished feat.
Well, you know, these trips are fascinating because you get the chance to spend, 48 hours plus with a group of senators talking about the subject at hand and nothing else. And as I wrote in an email that I sent out to folks that follow me, as I try to do when I come back from these trips, there were some divisions within the delegation. We were all supportive of economic aid. We were all supportive of sanctions. There was some disagreement as to whether we should provide military assistance to Ukraine. I am of the belief that that is not likely to be helpful, that there's really no short-term military support that we can give that will stop Russia from moving into eastern Ukraine. But others thought that we had a moral obligation to arm people, even if it wasn't going to be enough to get the job done. As to whether we can convince Russia to move back out of Crimea, I don't know. That milk may have been spilled at this point. But again, the interest for the United States, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as well, is really about the message that we're sending to other nations. For instance, China, which has disputes over the control of islands, both with the Philippines and Japan, if they get sort of the message that you can invade a territory, reset your borders, and they'll just be a slap on the wrist from the international community, well, then you might see these kind of things pop up all over the globe. So the interest is not just in Crimea or the Ukraine, and I think all of us, all eight of us that were there, agreed that this was a pretty important moment in the history of global affairs.
Let's hear a little bit from Senator John McCain, who was traveling, of course, with Chris Murphy.
We're not talking about troops on the ground. We are talking about responses that impose sanctions and punishment for Vladimir Putin.
Okay, so what are those sanctions and punishments that Senator McCain and you are talking about here?
So we've already announced a set of very specific sanctions against Russian individuals who were effectively in the chain of command that ordered this invasion. That's an important message, but let's be honest, that alone doesn't change the calculus in Moscow. So the next step, now that it's very clear that they are going to and have annexed effectively Crimea, is economic sanctions. Now, those are tougher to swallow for the countries that are imposing them because Russia does have the ability to bite back. If we were to move forward with sanctions on Russian petrochemical companies to perhaps stop or decrease the gas flow into Europe, if we were to sanction Russian banks that have loads of money in Europe, places like Frankfurt and London, that would have catastrophic type effects for the Russian economy, which is at a perilous moment to begin with. But it would also have effects on Europe, not as much, I think, in the United States. Again, I just think that if we understand the message that this aggression unchecked has for the world, Europe would be smart to join with us on these next level sanctions against the Russian economy.
And I know European leaders meeting today and talking about some of this. So what can Europe do? What can Europe add to U.S.-led sanctions in order to bite a little harder against Vladimir Putin?
Well, Europe can essentially – they can do a host of things. They can – look for other sources of energy other than Russian energy companies. That's not easy, but it is possible given some of the other opportunities to bring in gas. The United States can help with that. We have LNG resources that maybe not in the short term but in the medium and long term can help the European economy. They can freeze the assets of a greater number of Russian individuals. They can stop their companies from doing business with Russian banks. What the question here for Putin is how much economic pain is he willing to sustain? He had 50,000 people out in the streets of Moscow last weekend protesting this invasion. Now, that's actually a pretty big deal in Russia to get 50,000 people out given the reprisals that normally come against those organizers. If you see a cratering of the Russian economy, which won't happen overnight, I mean this will happen over a longer period of time, there will be a level of economic and popular unrest that makes Putin very uncomfortable and will certainly at least chill his ambitions to march into other places like Moldova, back into parts of Georgia or into eastern Ukraine.
But before we take a break, I just have to ask you a question about these sanctions. I understand that after the U.S. imposed some sanctions on individuals, Vladimir Putin made his own list of people in the United States government who are going to be have sanctions imposed against them. Were you one of those people?
I won't take it personally if I'm not on the list, but
you don't know if you're on the list.
No, I don't. I don't think their list has actually been released. I think it's only been sort of speculation as to who's going to be on the list. There's had been some speculation that all the members of our trip are going to be on that list. You know, I mean, it will have a personal effect on my life. I mean, I own about a 30% stake in Gazprom. So if I all of a sudden can't do business in Russia, then it's going to fundamentally change my investment structure.
Yeah,
so.
I'm sure. I read that with some interest, and I thought I thought you might be disappointed if you weren't on the list. But we'll see.
Well, I told people, yeah. I told the folks that John McCain in particular, like if you really want to make John McCain angry, Russia would not put him on the list. That would actually be the thing that would be a sanction on John McCain.
I know. I'm sure of that. We're speaking today with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy about the ongoing situation in Ukraine. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by two professors following this story closely. We'll talk about further steps that the U.S. can take. Before the Senate broke for a week-long recess without voting on a Ukraine aid bill, here's what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said on the Senate floor.
The first legislative matter we will take up when we get back here is going to be this. There's nothing that I know of at this time that's more important than this. So senators should be aware of this. This is nothing that we're going to run from. We're going to act on it as soon as we get back. It's really too bad that we haven't been able to move forward on this. We should have. We could have, but we're not going to. But we're going to move to it as soon as we get back.
When we get back, we'll continue our conversation. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're continuing the conversation on Ukraine. Conversations turned largely from the internal protests in Kiev to Vladimir Putin and Russia's role in the world. Now, here's Arizona Senator John McCain speaking about the U.S. relationship with Russia on CNN last weekend.
The United States of America, first of all, has to have a fundamental reassessment of our relationship with Vladimir Putin. No more reset buttons, no more tell Vladimir I'll be more flexible. Treat him for what he is. That does not mean reignition of the Cold War, but it does mean treating him in the way that we understand an individual who believes in restoring the old Russian empire.
And that's, again, John McCain speaking on CNN. We're joined today by Senator Chris Murphy, who just returned from a second trip to Kiev, looking closely at the situation, traveling with Senator McCain. We're also joined today by Greg Adams, who's chairman of the SCSU Sociology Department, a Fulbright scholar who did his work in Ukraine in 2003 and 2004. He served as an elections monitor during the 2004 Orange Revolution there. Greg, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And I also want to welcome in Kevin Buterbal, who's a SCSU Associate Professor of Political Science and an expert on international relations. He currently teaches a class on war and U.S. security policy. Kevin, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, first of all, before we get to some phone calls at 860-275-7266, if you might pick up on what we just heard from Senator McCain and what we've been hearing from Senator Chris Murphy about the U.S. response and reaction to Russia's role in all this. Kevin, I'll ask you.
Oh, that's a really good question. It's very clear that Putin believes that the 90s were a period of humiliation for the Russians and the country of Russia, and he wants to address and make changes on the ground to eliminate that humiliation. And part of what we're then seeing is what he did in Georgia in, 2008, what he's done now in Crimea, and in essence working on his near abroad to kind of re-expand or reconstitute the Russian empire. And so to some extent, I would agree with McCain that we probably have to take a harder line with Russia and make it clear that we're not going to tolerate kind of that rebuilding of an empire in the region.
I just want to get back to this idea of what exactly we can do to impose this, Senator Murphy. Yes, indeed, economic sanctions could take a bite in a country like Russia that is obviously economically not as strong as it could be. Let's just put it that way. I think one of the questions that we have with someone like Putin, as we've had with many other dictators or people around the world who are acting in a way that we don't want, they don't seem to play by the same rules as us. They don't seem to take harsh sanctions in the way that we in the United States might take harsh sanctions. Can we really do anything to influence someone who wants to rebuild a Russian empire, for instance?
I think we can, again, because we know that Putin is very worried about the Russian street. And frankly, one of the reasons why he cares so much about what has been happening in Kyiv for the last several months is that he doesn't want to have that kind of unrest on his doorstep. So he's got to put a stop to this sort of flowering of street-based democracy in Kyiv so that it doesn't happen in Moscow. Here's another way, though, that we can counter this aggression. We can take another look at expanding NATO. There's two narratives of NATO. Some people say, well, if Ukraine and Georgia were in NATO, then we would have an obligation to defend them, and wouldn't that be a big mess? The other narrative is that if Ukraine and Georgia had been part of NATO, Russia would have never moved on them in the first place. And so if you want to essentially stop his aggression where it stands today, then one of the most important questions over the next couple of years is whether or not we can get some of these border countries that are at risk under the umbrella of shared security.
Kevin, does that sound right to you?
First, sanctions don't have a really good history of success, especially against great powers. And in fact, there is some evidence that sanctions on dictatorial regimes often backfire, that they can be used to prop up support by creating scarcity in the country. On the question of NATO, I'm not sure that expansion at this point is going to address pushing them back. But I think it's very clear that how we react to what is taking place in the Ukraine is sending messages to our NATO allies, and especially the newest ones in the East, about our commitment to them and their security. And so by not taking a reasonably hard line, we're kind of communicating to them that we might not fully defend them if they need to be defended as well.
I want to go to the phones quickly. Fred is calling from a cell phone. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to ask a couple of questions really quickly, and then I'll listen off the phone.
Sure.
But a couple of things I've read in the paper. One, does Putin's annexation of Crimea, is that sort of a response to a weak American foreign policy? I read a lot about that from conservative pundits and columnists that because we didn't take a hard line in Syria or Iran or wherever, then Putin has nothing to fear from us. Second, one of the justifications that Vladimir Putin has used is that there's a significant fascist element in Ukraine which threatens ethnic Russians. How credible does the panel feel that is?
Those are two great questions, Fred, and I really appreciate you asking them. I'll go to you first, Kevin, but I want to hear from all of our panelists about these two things. Let's get to the second question first, if you don't mind, this idea of fascism threatening Russians in Ukraine.
I think I'm going to defer to Greg more on that one since he has a lot more knowledge on the ground. So
well,
let me
Greg?
Throw that at Greg.
Well, I think there's a history in Western Ukraine of preserving particularly the Ukrainian language, which has been outlawed at many times throughout history over hundreds of years, and that ethnic Ukrainians who still speak Ukrainian and the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States have a real vested interest in maintaining the health of that language. And so you have these – there have been these kind of hyper-nationalist youth movements in Ukraine. They're not representative of the Ukrainian youth, by the way. But and they're not widely popular. There are some people who – even when I was last there in 2006, there was this embarrassment on some level at the Ukraine at the expense of all others. This is a very small portion of Ukraine. Most of mainstream Ukrainians are very pragmatic. That's something they share with the United States.
And of course, one of the things that often happens, especially in Europe, is if you want to – set the conversation about any conflict on fire, you just say that there is fascism involved. If you just use that word, it becomes a club that can be used in the public, in the press.
Well, and let me be clear. We're really talking about what is now a political party called Svoboda. And members of this party were present on Maidan. They were and I think they're being – there is some extent to which there is a little more favorable embrace of them simply because of their nationalism in the face of the crackdowns.
I think Svoboda enjoyed support as a reaction to the Yanukovych government.
Yes.
There's a lot of feeling on the ground that Svoboda is losing popular support now that there is a new government installed. But John, on this first question, which is a pretty well-defined Republican talking point right now, that it's American weakness that allowed for Putin to do this, the facts just don't back that up. If the argument goes that by invading countries that you show American strength and then prevent people like Putin from advancing on neighbors, then the American invasion of Iraq would have stopped or convinced Putin against going against Georgia in 2008. The fact is that Putin has had these extraterritorial ambitions under Republican presidents and under Democratic presidents. I think the real frame here is whether this is a sign of Russian strength or Russian weakness. It's important to remember that just about a month ago, Russia effectively had control of the entirety of the Ukrainian government while Yanukovych was there. He had stopped them from joining Europe, and in what I would argue was a pretty panicked reaction to Yanukovych's departure, he has used military force in one portion of the country. So, there's a lot of people crowing about what a strong move this is by Putin. Several weeks ago, he had the second biggest country in Europe effectively under his thumb. He now has control of 5% of that country's territory, but the other 95% looks to be on its way towards a legal association with Europe. That's not a strong position for Russia. That's a weak position for Russia.
Do you agree?
I actually think that the speed of Putin kind of tells us that he's worried about the United States and our reaction. And in fact, he's trying to create conditions on the ground so quickly that we can't react to them and actually then change them, which actually means that we are credible rather than the opposite. So to some extent, I agree very much with Senator Murphy. I don't think there was anything about our policy itself that communicated to Putin that he could get away with this.
I think a big part of the Republican talking points, as you call them and as the caller called them, certainly Senator Murphy, is the way that we reacted in Syria. It's the idea of setting a red line that then we don't actually have any reprisals for when someone crosses it. Again, whether that has anything to do with how Vladimir Putin, who seems to write his own rules on a daily basis, if that had anything to do with how he reacts, nobody will ever know. But that is something that people have certainly pointed to and look at, that the United States' weakness on Syria certainly has emboldened some people around the world?
Well, you know, red line, right, is probably the most overused, misunderstood term in American diplomacy. I don't read the word red line to mean if you cross it, you are going to have the American military marching on you. I understand it to be a way to convey what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And there are a variety of ways to respond when you have crossed a red line. You don't always have to march the American army into a foreign country. So in this case, he has crossed a red line. That red line was that you violated treaties that you have signed and invaded another sovereign nation. And we're going to use, in this case, economic and political pressure to try to send that message. But again, I just don't read any of the actions that we've taken in other parts of the globe to have inspired Russian moves into Crimea. This has been a longstanding ambition for Putin. And when he has an opportunity to try to recast the borders of the country and influence the near abroad, he's going to take it.
Before we get to another phone call, I just want to stay with this theme, though, of U.S. foreign policy in a larger sense. I'm wondering, Kevin, if you might talk a little bit about U.S. foreign policy in regards to Russia and how it plays into the situation in Syria, how it plays into right now a developing situation with Iran and Israel. How much in your mind are all of these things and these relationships tied together?
This is a very difficult problem because we've been partnering with Russia, especially in dealing with Iran. And if we end up going back into a very cold relationship with the Russians, one of the ways they could seriously hurt our interests in Western Europe would be to remove cooperation from those kinds of efforts. So, I mean, it looked like the sanctions on Iran had finally started to move them in a direction to disarm. We obviously have gotten the Syrians to start giving up their chemical weapons, and to lose Russia on those particular items would be very harmful to us and possibly undermine them. So you might see Assad suddenly decide, I'm not going to do that, and the Iranians walk away from the agreement as well.
Do you have some of those same worries, Senator?
I have the same worries, but I think that that concern is underlaid by an assumption that Russia was cooperating with us because of their relationship with the United States. And I would argue that it is much more likely that they were working with us on Iran or Syria or counterterrorism or Afghanistan because it was in their direct interest to do that. And so now that doesn't mean that in a peak at the United States because of these sanctions, they could walk away from their own interest and do something that would both harm us and themselves. But I think they've been in the game on a lot of these other issues because they have concerns about Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon, because they have concerns about a runaway regime in Damascus, because they care about the security of Afghanistan. And I'm not sure that those interests disappear.
Well, and that's, I guess, one of my earlier points is that it seems as though Russia may often act against its own best interests, the interests of its people, its economic interests, because it has these ambitions to recreate some sort of a Russian empire. The fact that they may be working with the United States because they want to be friendly with the U.S., or they may be working with the United States on Iran because they just want to protect themselves, honestly doesn't really matter, because as Kevin suggests, they could change their mind and it could be very bad for our relations in those countries.
Yeah, no, and that is where Kevin is right, is that, you know, clearly it's hard to figure out how this move is in the Russian best interest. They are essentially expelling themselves from the international community. They are now no longer effectively a member of the G8, and that probably is just the beginning of the international forums in which they lose favor. There is going to be enormous pain to the Russian economy, which, by the way, already before this crisis had been downgraded to an estimate of 1% growth over the next year. They've got enormous problems with demographics, the lower value of Russian gas to deal with. So, no, I get it. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you see Russia try to undermine some of these other efforts. But I just don't think we have any choice. I mean, I think the alternative, which is just to sort of sit back and pretend this didn't happen and hope Russia sticks with us on these other negotiations that we're involved with them with, sends a terrible message to the rest of the world and other countries that may be thinking of taking this kind of action.
Greg, did you want to jump in?
I did. Even speaking with respect to foreign policy, to the extent that we've turned our attention toward Vladimir Putin, I think it's in America's best interest, in the United States' best interest, to see a strong, democratic, and unified Ukraine. I think that needs to be a large component of the foreign policy, and Senator Murphy earlier in this discussion talked about ways in which we could support that. I want to steer the conversation just briefly toward Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine, because that's who Putin seems to be targeting for this to the extent that there's any truth to it, this illusion that he has popular support anywhere. And one of the mistakes I think we make from a distance when we try to understand a conflict in a country, we like black and white. We like East and West. It's kind of the Ukrainian speakers versus the Russian speakers in this case. But there is a broad range of perspectives among Ukrainian speakers. There's a broad range of perspectives among Russian speakers. And one of the mistakes that the interim government made when they came to power immediately was to pass a law – this happened in the wake of the Orange Revolution – was to pass a law proclaiming Ukrainian as the national language. Now, they immediately noticed that was a mistake and withdrew that law. But it spooked, I would say, Russian speakers, even Russian-speaking Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine because of what I think is a legitimate fear of marginalization. And so if there's going to be a unified Ukraine, there needs to be a real orchestrated effort to reach out to the Russian-speaking eastern Ukrainians. Again, they're not all ethnic Russians. They're not all longing for the days of the Soviet Union.
We're talking today about Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia. We're talking with Greg Adams from Southern Connecticut State University from their sociology department. He served as an elections monitor during the 2004 Orange Revolution in Ukraine. We'll be talking with him more about his time there. Kevin Butterball is a SCSU Associate Professor of Political Science and an expert on international relations. And also joining us in studio is Senator Chris Murphy, who just returned from a trip to Kiev. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Kenneth, who is calling from Woodbridge. Hello, Kenneth.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I'm calling to propose a move to defuse the situation via an internationally acceptable way of transferring territory from one country to another. That is the purchase of land from one country by another. And what I'm suggesting is, why don't we propose a referendum in the entire Ukraine asking whether they would like to sell part or all of Crimea to Russia? If that is accepted, then it's a win-win situation, diffusing the situation from Russia's standpoint, and the money that would be gotten from this purchase would go a long way to paying off the national debt of Ukraine.
Kenneth, thank you very much. Is this a reasonable proposal? Thank you very much for the thought, Senator Murphy.
It's not likely to be a reasonable proposal. I don't think there's any amount of money that would convince Ukrainians to give up the territory of Crimea. I think, though, it does sort of cause us to just frame another piece of this discussion for a second, which is that Russia holding Crimea and only Crimea is a really difficult position and a headache for Russia. And that's why a lot of us are worried about what happens next, because Crimea is separated from Russia by land. All of the gas lines, the water lines, the roads that come into Crimea come from Ukraine. And so Crimea alone, though it's got sort of strategic and cultural importance to the Russians because, of course, it used to be part of Russia until it was given away, strategically it's not enough. And so if Russia was ever going to buy Crimea outright, they probably would want to buy a little strip of land that gets their people and their trucks from Russia into Crimea, which is another reason why that arrangement might not work.
I want to go to Robert in New Haven quickly. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, if you look at the – if we turn – just to play devil's advocate, and we turn back the clock before the Russians and Putin went into the area, how credible is the present interim government? I mean, they overthrew a democratically elected president. I mean, so why is it that they're credible? And, you know, just to be devil's advocate, why shouldn't we think that we're going to have the same problem there someday that we have in Libya? You know, we backed rebels, and now we don't have any control there. Look, the first thing they did is they, you know, tried to nationalize a language.
Well, and this is – Robert, first of all, it's a great question. I think, Senator Murphy, you addressed this a little bit before. Really, the people of Ukraine want a government that works for them. This is yet another instance where we see a transition in the world, where someone who we see as a despot leaves, and we fill the void with what? We're not exactly sure. Robert's asking a very good question. How credible is the government that's there right now?
And listen, people drew issue with McCain and I going there. Some people, Russia included, perceived it to be us advocating for the overthrow of what was a democratically elected president. And, you know, the the quality of the election may not measure up to the quality of U.S. elections, but nobody doubted that Yanukovych was elected with a majority. The problem was is that he lost his legitimacy when he effectively turned guns on his own people. And he was forced out of town in part because he turned snipers on the protesters, killing 100 people. And that, I think, made it a very different game here. The quality of the new government, well, it's not inclusive. There are lots of groups that are not part of this new government, including Yanukovych's old party, which represents a lot of eastern Ukraine. It is essentially another set of politicians being substituted for a prior set of politicians. And, of course, the hope is that they don't go the way of every previous administration and just use the government to enrich themselves. But it's our duty right now, having this government been selected by legitimate constitutional means, to support them, and that's why the economic aid is so important. We'll see in the end how well they do running the country, but this is a legitimate government that I think deserves our support.
I'd like to get a quick comment from Greg and Kevin before our break.
Yeah, I think back to the 2004 Orange Revolution. In the wake of that, the United States there was a free and fair election on December 26, 2004, and in the wake of that election, the United States didn't recognize the results of the election, put off recognizing those results until after the inauguration of the new president. I think that was a mistake. I think that the United States recognizing the interim government, even – it's imperfect. I understand. And it's – I think Senator Murphy described the situation there very well. There will be a new election on May 25th.
Right.
And that is the election that I think we all need to pay very close attention to and make sure that we would that we validate the outcome.
I would actually agree with that. I think that because you're moving very rapidly to an election in May, that this interim government knows that it's not particularly legitimate and it's going to be legitimized through a proper election in May.
And I think what you have to watch here is the Russians, because to the extent that they have any interest in dealing, one of the conditions of that deal is going to be for the Russians this election being postponed, because they don't have much of an ability right now on a May election to try to manipulate the result to get a pro-Russian candidate. Indeed, of the major candidates that are running for president, none of them are pro-Russian in the sense that they would abandon the European Union. And so you have to be very careful to watch what the Russians are going to try to do and negotiate, which would push that election off, which I think would be disastrous for the country.
We're talking with Senator Chris Murphy, who just returned from a trip to Ukraine, also with Greg Adams and Kevin Butterball from SCSU, Southern Connecticut State University. Both Greg and Kevin will be taking part in a panel discussion at Southern Connecticut called Crisis in Ukraine, What Happened and What's Next. It's on Monday, March 31st at noon. More information on our website, WNPR.org. When we come back, we're going to take more of your calls at 860-275-7266 and questions about Ukraine, Russia, in Crimea, here on Where We Live.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, because of the potato famine of the mid-1800s, Ireland lost almost 3 million people. More than 1 million died from starvation and related diseases. 2 million people emigrated. We're going to take a walking tour of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University to learn more about the history, why it matters to Americans today. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking about Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia, what it all means to us and why we should care, with Chris Murphy. He's, of course, a U.S. senator from Connecticut who just returned from a trip with other senators to Ukraine. Greg Adams and Kevin Butterball are from SCSU. They're going to be holding a conversation on Monday about this crisis in Ukraine, what happened and what's next. More information on our website, WNPR.org. I should also say that this is Sunday at 7 o'clock in our essential radio slot, where we have specials and documentaries from the public radio world. It is an Intelligence Squared special that was just taped this week. It's called Is Russia a Marginal Power? It's a long-form conversation debating this very important topic. And it's Sunday at 7 on Essential Radio here on WNPR. Let's go back to the phones here. Richard in Mystic wants to get involved. So, hi, Richard. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for letting me be on. Chris, I want to thank you for sending out that email that you sent after your recent trip. It was very moving. But what I'm concerned about is that, and I want to make a comment and get your reaction, is the big historical perspective. We're looking at Putin, we're looking at the Cold War, but this situation goes back to probably before Catherine the Great, when Russia has always felt a need for a warm water port. I think we need to recognize from their view that this is something maybe akin to the Cuban Missile Crisis with us, that we have moved into their area that they have felt was very important. I'm not saying that's right, and I'm very much supportive of the Ukrainian people and their right for self-determination, but we also have to look at the real politics of this situation. And perhaps there is some legitimacy in the political, geopolitical sense of Russia saying we need Crimea, the rest of Ukraine is important to us, but Crimea is their red line. And if we recognize that, maybe we can begin to build on a compromise that works for everyone.
So I admit to, you know, having a pretty steep learning curve on the history of the region. But, you know, when you go to Kyiv and see the great churches that still remain, they were built during a time when that city was called Kyiv on Rus. And I ultimately think this is not about Crimea. I think this really is about Kyiv. I think this is about a belief that Ukraine and Kyiv is a historical part of Russia, that it is a tremendous loss to his ambitions to rebuild the Soviet Empire if the majority, the vast majority of that country becomes a fully, truly European nation. I agree that he has a strategic interest in Crimea and a psychological interest in Crimea, but I think this is much bigger and broader. And that's why I don't think this story is over. I just don't think this thing ends with the annexation of Crimea and the joining of Ukraine without greater incident to the European Union. I think this ultimately is a deeper issue about where Putin thinks Ukraine should be in the world order of things.
Did you have a thought, Kevin?
I think it's very clear that Crimea strategically is very important, and the kind of warming up of Ukraine to the West and the idea that it might eventually join NATO clearly places serious or creates serious problems for Russia. Imagine if we had a major military base in a strategic location in a territory that then was going to join an alliance that was designed specifically against us. We would probably take action as well. That does not legitimize the way they've gone about protecting that interest, but it does give us an idea for why they've done what they've done.
You've just effectively answered a question that came in from Darwin in an email, was asking about that very same thing.
I just say I think that's a really good point, and it speaks to the greater difficulty here, which is that, well, we're not going back to the Cold War. The world isn't oriented around who's with the United States and who's with Russia. There are a lot of other paradigms that matter more to us. Ultimately, we want Russia to be part of Europe, and it's in Russia's economic interest to be fully integrated into Europe. And we have now sort of set up this this dichotomy in which Europe is on one side and Russia is on the other side, and we're talking about expanding NATO again. And that may be the reality that we have to exist in while Putin is in control, who sees the world that way as well. But when we talk about the global arc of history, the hope is, and maybe I'm naive about this, is that eventually we can convince the Russians that it's in their interest to not be at odds economically or politically with the West and with Europe, but that they should be part of that union.
I want to get to a quick email that came in from Nina. The problem for Americans, she writes, is not that they are projecting enough power, but that they have lost the moral ground from which to complain about Putin. I think that the only Americans who have a right to complain about Putin's aggression against Ukraine are those who are against the U.S. assault against Iraq. We've gotten a couple more phone calls to this end as well. And Senator Murphy, it comes back to this question about how the United States has exerted itself in the world over the course of the last decade plus.
Well, I mean, listen, Putin very clearly makes the argument that how can you complain about me marching into a foreign country to protect my interests when you did the same in Iraq. Now, for those of us who opposed that invasion and opposed that war, we suggest that two wrongs don't make a right. I think that the underlying premise, which is that the United States has to be more careful about the messages that we send and the standards that we set in the way that we conduct our foreign policy, it does matter. So I don't necessarily dispute the underlying criticism of prior U.S. policy, but that doesn't provide any kind of justification for what Putin has done here.
Before we run low on time, I want to turn back to Greg Adams. You were serving as an elections monitor during the 2004 Orange Revolution. You did work in that country over the course of a few years. First of all, I guess I'm wondering if you can take us back to that time and how much you feel as though the results of the Orange Revolution, the election that we were talking about earlier, led up to what we're seeing today. What do you think back on about that time that sort of precedes this and makes you think that maybe it had some influence here?
Well, I think there was a lot of optimism in the Orange Revolution, and I think there was a lot of disappointment in its wake, and a lot of that really does have to do with how the language issue was managed. I'm an advocate for the Ukrainian language, but I'm also an advocate. The reality is that Ukraine is a bilingual country, and that's something that we have to accept. Even the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States has to work with that. One of the things that – and there are a lot of political reasons that I'm sure Senator Murphy can speak to about why things didn't turn out as expected in the wake of the Orange Revolution. But I think there was a step forward because prior to the Orange Revolution, there was state control of the news media in Ukraine. And that meant that Kuchma at the time and ultimately Putin could direct the message out of all of the broadcast media, whether it was television or radio and much of the print media. Afterwards, there was a loosening of this, and it was the ability of Ukrainians to communicate through media, to not be kind of closed down, that I think allowed in part and social media. I have to give Facebook its due. That allowed young people, and that's really how this started, was with young college students from Taras Shevchenko University, from Kyiv Mohyla University, who began to protest in late November. So I think there was a little bit of incremental progress, at least in the Fourth Estate.
Mm. Do you have some thoughts on that, Senator, quickly?
No, and I think that is the story of why this movement on Maidan continued, was that you had Channel 5 and, you know, other domestic sources telling the real story. Now, that, of course, is also the story as to why Crimea has gone south so quickly, is that when the referendum was announced, Russia did take down Ukrainian television. If you just spend a couple days in Kyiv today, you still see the ability of Russian television and radio to spread some really terrible propaganda throughout the rest of the country. So, you know, there's a fascinating propaganda war that is being played out today, but at least the Ukrainians now have a fighting chance because they've got their own sources.
Kevin, just before we run low on time, the talk that you're going to give next Monday is about what's next. What do you think is next here?
Oh, my gosh. That is a really tough question.
I'm not asking you to predict the final four or anything, but I'm asking you to predict this.
I think that we're going to see a ratcheting up of sanctions. It's going to go from people to much larger sanctions on Russia itself. We will try to drag our European partners in with us. We need the Germans in particular. The Germans have very tight and large economic relations with the Russians, and if we're going to make them hurt, the Germans have to come along. I do not think that we're going to be able to turn the Crimea back into a piece of the Ukraine. I think that's gone and probably gone for good.
You have a thought quickly, Greg?
I wish I didn't agree. I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful for a united Ukraine, certainly north of the Crimean Peninsula. I'm optimistic for that. But I think it's going to take a lot of work. And I think that's the one thing I would want to emphasize. I know I have to be brief, but that there is a lot of work ahead, not just for Ukraine, but for the West.
And we do have about 30 seconds left. But what is next? I mean, an aid package to Ukraine, but what else are we looking at here, Senator?
Well, I think I'd have a better chance of predicting the Final Four than predicting how this situation is going to
play out.
Warren
Buffett's got some money for you.
I know. Tough sanctions, real work with Europe to make sure that they move with us, continued economic support for the government in Ukraine, and an imposition of economic reforms that are necessary that move on a schedule so you don't create more immediate unrest in the Ukraine because of difficult economic reforms that might undermine the new government. I think that's our best shot to try to stabilize what is left of Ukraine and try to stop the aggression at least where it stands.
Senator Chris Murphy just returned from Kyiv. Thank you again so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks also to Greg Adams and Kevin Butterball from SCSU, Southern Connecticut State University. They'll be holding a conversation about this issue coming up on Monday. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank
for
you.
Being here. We'll end with this tweet that came in from our friends at the World Affairs Council. We need to focus not on what we want, but what Ukrainians want. You can continue the conversation online at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live.